Hello, in this week's Brewin podcast with me, Guy Foster, I'm going to be speaking to Mike Fox of Royal London, who runs the Royal London Sustainable Leaders Trust. And we're going to be talking about how Mike approaches the topical and complex area of sustainable investing. But bear in mind, we can't guarantee sources from outside Brewin Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember, Mike's been doing a great job at the helm of Sustainable Leaders since 2003, quite an innings. But that doesn't mean when investing your capital isn't at risk or investment values can't increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations or that future performance can't differ from that of the past. Of course, all of those things can happen. So bear that in mind. And with that, let's get on with the podcast and hear from Mike. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Brewin podcast with me, Guy Foster, the head of research here at Brewin Dolphin. And we're going to be joined in this podcast by Mike Fox. So Mike is the manager of the Royal London Sustainable Leaders Trust. And so the theme really is going to be about understanding Mike and his team's approach to sustainable investing. So Mike, thanks very much for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite.
I think if we could start with a sort of quite a high level question. What is it really that distinguishes the approach, the investment approach that you're taking from one that would be more traditional?
Yeah, so I mean, if you look at it from an analytical perspective, I guess we say we just have a broader range of inputs. So most traditional fund managers would only consider, you know, financial metrics, P&Ls, balance sheets, cash flows, those kind of things, whereas we do that, but we also say that we think environmental, social, corporate governance issues, which we badge together in a version we call sustainability, can equally influence investment outcomes. And actually, because it's been a much less trodden path, for reasons we can talk about, that actually there's often more market inefficiencies there than otherwise. So an operational perspective is a broader range of inputs that includes ESG and financial. From a product perspective, what's different is, you know, we really go out to clients and say, look, you know, any fund can give you a financial return, and we do that as well. But if you want to know your money is supporting the transition to a more sustainable economy, helping decarbonize energy, helping, you know, cure cancer and a whole bunch of other things, and we can offer you that as well. So, you know, we offer both, you know, strong financial and non-financial return in the way that the product is managed.
Okay, so would you say, so has the product got financial and non-financial objectives then?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's the two sides of the same coin, because I think, you know, more sustainable companies at the end of the day, we think are just going to be better investments anyway. But, you know, the goal of the non-financial goals, so to speak, of the fund is to support the transition to a more sustainable society. So, you know, there's an explicit remit there to go and use capital in a way that does support some of these key transitions that all of us can see in front of our eyes. And in doing that, you know, we think we can deliver a better investment return than a traditional approach would.
Okay, and so it was a more sustainable society, was it you said? So, I mean, how do you, that's quite a broad concept, and there's always sort of trade-offs involved in what different companies add and take from the economy. Do you have any kind of framework or anything to help you sort of prioritize what's going to make that more sustainable society?
Yeah, it's a fair point. I mean, you're right, it is quite a general term. It's a bit like saying you're a growth fund, isn't it? It's like there's like 100 different derivatives of a growth fund. So we would say that every company we look at either goes into bucket A or bucket B. And bucket A is, you know, companies that provide solutions to environmental and social issues. Bucket A also includes companies that have high ESG standards. Bucket B is companies that cause those environmental and social issues, and bucket B is, you know, companies that have poor ESG standards. So really, a sustainable company for us, it comes down to, you know, are you part of the solution and do you have good ESG standards, or are you part of the problem and have bad ESG? And we really focus our investments on bucket A and avoid bucket B.
Okay, so I mean, maybe we can think about some examples there then. So I think you've got some banks within the portfolio. They have a reputation, I guess, for being prepared to lend to companies without necessarily having a big focus and a sense of responsibility for what they're lending that money towards. Is that something that you have to dig into when you're looking at banks?
Oh, definitely. So, you know, we own one bank, Lloyds, in the fund at the moment, and you know, we've owned other ones in the past, but I think in terms of how we filter them, first of all, you know, we do think basic banking products are socially positive. You know, they help with financial inclusion. You know, we're talking about savings, mortgages, current accounts. And I think if you look at countries that don't have banking systems that are as prevalent as ours, you can observe that they are socially and economically kind of detrimented by that. So we do think basic banking products have social value to them. I think where we have to be careful is if you get into the realms of investment banking, for example, where I still think there is a case for it, but I think it's more or more opaque. And then obviously as well, we need to be interested in the loan books of the banks we invest in and understanding, you know, what kind of entities that they are lending to. And all of those things are part of the analytical process, the output of which is we typically really keep our funds more towards the you know, simpler lending practices and simpler products. But it's an interesting example of a sector, and there are many where, you know, there is no simple answer for many of the things we look at. And in reality, we look at pluses and minuses and we add them up and we decide in totality, does it make sense to us?
So in terms of the lending books then, do you get do banks give you the appropriate disclosure you need to get confidence about that? Do they have to sort of generalize, or do they give specific details on names? How do you gain the comfort that you need?
It's mixed, to be fair. So, you know, we operate globally as well as in the UK, and you very much see different standards globally. It's interesting, if you look at an Australian bank, that's sort of a commodity orientated economy, and the disclosure is very good, actually. You might not like it in terms of what it lends to, but, you know, you'll get pretty granular breakdowns of where the loan books are. You know, other regions like the UK, it's patchy. You know, I think 5-10 years ago, it used to be very principles-based what banks would disclose. You know, so we will not lend to this and so on, but they wouldn't give you the breakdown of the loan books. That's starting to change. So, you know, obviously we're going to put a premium on banks that either clearly don't lend into these areas just because of the nature of them, or do fully disclose and we can understand what the risks are. But to your question, it's very varied when you go globally about how much disclosure you do get on loan books.
And I was interested as well, I suppose, you know, we're just going to focus on some of the sectors that have got a bit more controversy about them. But thinking about technology, obviously it's been a tremendous sector to have exposure to as investors. But I mean, there's seemingly numerous new kind of trials and antitrust complaints and privacy complaints going on at the moment. It's a sector where certainly there are a lot of people, including officials, who are not happy with some of the practices going on. So maybe you could just talk a little bit more about how you look at technology and the exposure you've got, and why you feel, I guess, in terms of those pluses and minuses, that they're part of the solution rather than part of the problem.
Yeah, it's a fair challenge. So, you know, we start off from the simple view that a large element of social and economic and environmental improvement over the years has its origins in technology. We think innovation, you know, is a reason why we actually are managing to get through this pandemic and survive it. I mean, if this had happened 20 years ago when we couldn't remote work and cloud computing didn't exist and a bunch of other things, it would have been a very different story. But you still got to granularize that. And if you think about products and services, you know, think about Google versus Facebook. So Google is fundamentally knowledge search, which we would argue is socially positive. Facebook is social media, which we would argue is socially negative. Now, that's quite a subjective judgment, but it begins to help you understand at least how you can differentiate. And then if you go on to ESG standards, similarly, so, you know, we can look at data privacy policies, we can look at actions around that, we can look at corporate governance structures, and we can differentiate in that way. So, you know, in terms of where we come out of this, certain technology companies we do invest in, like Google and Microsoft, certain ones we don't, like Facebook and Oracle. So, you know, there is a way of dealing with a sector that has issues and then picking the companies that have much more of the positives and less of the negatives, and that's the way that we operate.
And so when Google is in trouble for the way in which it presents and orders its search results, I mean, how do you take that into account? Does that has that meant that it's sailing a bit close to the wind, or in terms of your criteria, or do you think it's a sort of fuss about nothing? Or now, just give us your view on that. That'd be helpful.
Oh, I mean, I think it's interesting. You know, if you go to the supermarket, you know, the supplier that's prepared to pay the most to put their goods at the end of the aisle will get the goods at the end of the aisle. There is a commercial element to any advertising business and businesses that's trying to sell stuff. And in some respects, Google's doing no different than that. That, you know, it will prioritize, you know, outcomes that might be more beneficial to it commercially, in the same way that Tesco's would when you go to the supermarket. So I think the underlying principles are not that different. You know, I think what people struggle with is that, you know, things like regulation and society is very, very comfortable with physical things, but not very comfortable with the digital world, because it's all new. You know, politicians don't really know how to regulate it. Tax codes don't know how to tax it. And as consumers, you know, we quite rightly want to understand what happens to all of our data. But again, to use the kind of supermarket analogy, the first big data exercise I came across was Tesco Clubcard, where, you know, we basically gave Tesco our data in return for a penny a pound. And, you know, so it's not that these are fundamentally new models. I think the scale of them is bigger. You know, and I think at times technology companies haven't helped themselves by not being as transparent as they could be. But we don't think in isolation that is an issue that offsets the fact that knowledge search has been profoundly socially positive. So, you know, in the end, you have to put everything together and take a view. And people may take different views, by the way. We don't say we've got the answer, but we just try and put them through a consistent process and take a sensible judgment.
I'm interested, though, in your juxtaposition of as product search as being socially positive and social media as being negative. So, why do you see social media as being negative?
I think there's a few factors on that. I think at the end of the day, it's an attention-seeking thing. So if I go and not search for a piece of knowledge, I get that piece of knowledge on Google and I use it and I go off. When you go into the social media world, they are trying to get you addicted to their product. They're trying to get you more time on their platform so you'll see more advertising. And then I think, secondly, you know, there's a lot of evidence that in terms of the role of social media within elections, in terms of opinion forming, in terms of, you know, hate groups, you know, this idea that people just aggregate towards people with similar views and it progresses in that way. And because, you know, social media says we are not going to be an editor, you know, we're not going to curate what's on our sites like a newspaper would, you can get this wild west of, you know, opinions, views, influences on democratic processes that we just think it's not possible to do in the construct of knowledge search. So, you know, I think it's that will be our view. You know, and again, it's open for challenge. I mean, I think, you know, different generations have different perspectives on social media, for sure, and certainly younger generations we find tend to be more tolerant of it, you know, and time will tell who's right or wrong on that.
So, I mean, with big technology, there's often quite a hurdle to get over in terms of corporate governance standards. So how does that feed into your thinking? Is it that it's just not as severe as the benefits that are, but the negatives aren't as severe as the benefits that the company in question is offering?
Yes, there's a few points there. I mean, so a lot of the large technology companies who are listed in the US and US corporate governance standards are lower than the UK. So you've already got to start with a lower base. And from that, we do look at two things. We look at board composition. Actually, we look at three things: board composition, remuneration, and then also share structures as well. And that's where it gets mixed. So, you know, if you looked at Google, for example, it has a dual share class structure because the founders want to maintain a certain element of control. So we would definitely mark down for that. On the other side, it is a very well constructed board. And that is an offset on the plus side. You take about a company like Amazon. Amazon has probably got the best corporate governance of any of the large technology companies. It has no founding shareholder. The board is A1 in terms of diversity. And you just have to work through it. It's as simple as that. But to your point, it's like, it's weight of evidence, our approach. So clearly, if Google has a lower level of corporate governance standard than we would wish, then we will mark it down for that. And it will require more convincing on things like the social value of knowledge search for us to get comfortable with it. There are examples in the case of Tesla where we would score it basically zero for corporate governance. We would say almost there's no way we can support investing our capital in this company, no matter how socially positive the products and services are, because the dice are just so badly loaded against shareholders. So, you know, it's calibration, it's a range of variables, and then ultimately making a judgment as to where you draw the line on acceptability.
Well, I think it'd be wonderful to get just a bit more detail on that, given that Tesla's obviously been doing okay for shareholders this year in particular. So what are the specific points that mean that those dice are so heavily loaded?
So there's two things. You know, one is that we found reasonably persistent evidence that shareholder interests are being not looked after. So you can look at a shareholder structure and say, you know, you're not necessarily keen on that, but then you look at what the board does and actually it's very good. Or you can find shareholder structures where actually you might not like the board composition and that they're not doing a good job. So the two things on Tesla would be that they did an acquisition of a SolarCity a few years ago, which to us looked very much like a, you know, I think he was the chairman of SolarCity, and it was a business that looked to us like it was worthless and bought it for, a significant price. The second thing was that his remuneration requires a significant slug of ownership of Tesla to be transferred to him over the coming years. So, you know, the level of dilution, the amount we have to pay him to run the business, we think is so huge that it's just... it's not just representative of a financial risk, but it's also representative of a mentality that, you know, it's kind of his business. So, you know, I think those are the issues that we come across with Tesla. Which, by the way, I mean, you know, that's very different from not having admiration for what Tesla is trying to do. The automotive industry has huge vested interests that would not have been challenged had Tesla not come on board. VW doesn't want to sell electric cars. It wants to sell you very fancy, petrol-based cars. So you can have admiration for the company, but you can then say the corporate governance structure just does not support us making an investment.
Okay, and so, I mean, that just makes me ask you, I guess, because you mentioned diversity there, and obviously that's something that you... consider quite an important element, or a very important element, of a well-constructed and a good functioning board. I mean, how do you assess that the diversity, or what do you look for in terms of the diversity of a board?
There's some visible things. So, I mean, you can start with gender, and you can start with ethnicity, and gender is probably the key point that's been looked at in the last 5 years, and some progress has been made in that. It's very geographically orientated. So in Japan, if you see one female on the board, you think that's brilliant because most of them have none. I think in the UK we're doing an okay job, and actually when you get to like technology and science-led businesses in the US, they're great on it. I mean, the number of women who in science and technology in the US and on the board is very, very good. Ethnicity is becoming a bigger issue, but it's still earlier on in that. The other thing that's less easy to see is cognitive diversity. So, we, for example, we observed that a lot of businesses are digitizing at a very fast rate. A lot of businesses that weren't digital businesses. So, you know, we need to look at the composition of the board and understand if there's cognitive diversity. Do they have a skill set that allows the digitization of a company to be done in an appropriate and successful way? So you've got the visible factors, gender, ethnicity, and then you've got the skill factors, you know, in this case, digitization and data. And I think in the mix of those, you can get a pretty good sense as to how diverse a board is and how likely it is to manage the business successfully.
So, I mean, obviously, as you've highlighted, one of those sort of sets of diversity criteria is much more measurable or objectively measurable than the other. Do you think that investors are getting this sort of this balance right between those two types of criteria?
Probably not. I mean, I think, you know, when we talk about our own investment team here, we talk about diversity and we put a slide up and we show people that we don't look all the same, with different genders, with different ethnicities and so on. But when we talk to people, we say, look, that's not an inappropriate way to talk about diversity, but it is, we want people who think differently. We just want people who just don't agree with each other. You know, we want people who have had different social backgrounds, educational backgrounds, geographical backgrounds, you know, and we think that's the goal. So, you know, I think you do have to be a little bit careful that you don't oversimplify it and make it a visual thing. And you understand that the true goal is cognitive diversity. And I think, if I'm honest with you, going back to the point where we started the conversation about a broader range of inputs, I don't think traditional fund management has really spent a lot of time thinking about that. I mean, I think it's better than it was, but I don't think there's many people that would look at a board of a business that they were thinking of buying into and really doing the work on understanding where the diversity is within that, and then scoring it appropriately before making, you know, an investment decision.
Okay, then I want to bring you back then to, I guess, the interesting points that you're making about Tesla, what the, the corporate governance on one side, the amazing impact that the company is having on the other side. And so I want to use that really to ask you, you know, do you expect the investments that you make to be investments that make a difference to the world that we're living in? I know you've said obviously that you're looking for companies that are making a difference, but are you expecting your actions as investors to make a difference?
I think over time and in a holistic way, I think the answer to that is yes. You know, we don't claim, because we invest in secondary equities, pre-existing equity, that we are impact investors with a big I. You know, we buy our equity off other shareholders. If we go and buy 1% of a renewable energy company off another shareholder, that company is not going to build more renewable energy because we bought 1% of the company. If it issued more equity in the future, then we could claim impact. But 99% of the time, we invest in pre-existing equity. So we have to be really careful that we don't overclaim impact with a big I. Where we do have influence is, especially because sustainable investing is acting at scale now, is that we regularly sit in front of companies and say, we will only give you access to our capital if you behave in a certain way, if you do certain things. You see this in the credit space quite a lot, actually. Equities is evolving, and that's where you have influence. And in terms of who you're prepared to give your capital to and who you're not, over a long period of time, you do genuinely see certain sectors, you know, performing better, both financially and from a sustainable perspective versus others. And I think that's where we claim to have influence. We say we've got impact with a small I, you know, rather than impact with a big I.
Okay, well, I think we're beginning to run out of time. I wonder if you could, I wonder if I could just give you a sort of a moment to talk about perhaps some of the, one or two of the most exciting opportunities that you've got in the fund, and both the sort of financial and non-financial things that they're bringing.
Yeah, I mean, so we start off with the biggest holding in the fund, which is AstraZeneca. I mean, AstraZeneca is, along with Roche, which actually is also in the fund, the world-leading cancer franchise. So they are operating in areas such as immunology, and genetics to give us a roadmap to the actual curing of cancer, which is, alongside heart disease, the biggest killer of people still. It's a very complex disease. It's one that cutting edge science is still unpicking, but they are making very considerable progress in areas such as lung cancer and improving the outcomes for patients. And if you do that, you don't need to worry too much about how much money the company is going to make, because that's clearly going to be very profitable. The cost of caring for cancer globally is immense, so if you can provide a solution to that, then that's that's very good. And another company we often get asked about is Rentokil. So, not many people talk about Rentokil and say they're exciting, but, it's a hygiene business. It's a pest control business. And, if you look around the world at what's going on at the moment, health and hygiene standards will have to be structurally higher going forward, to get people back in offices, to get people comfortable with living the lives they used to lead. That, the whole kind of construct around how hygiene is dealt with will have to change, and Rentokil is a world leader in that. So it's a relatively traditional business, been around for a long time, but the pandemic is going to be hugely beneficial to their future prospects.
Okay, all right, well thanks Mike. Great to hear a couple of good UK names there as well, and names that probably be familiar to quite a few investors. So thanks a lot for talking us through your approach. And thanks also to all of our listeners. We hope you found this foray into sustainable investing interesting. No doubt we will be covering this topic a lot more in the future as well. And we hope that you'll be able to join us again next time on the next Brewin podcast.